I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama spoke at the University of Cape Town on Sunday and remarked on the economic progress that Africa has been enjoying in recent years.
Many of the fastest growing economies in the world are here in Africa, where there's a historic shift taking place from poverty to a growing nascent middle class. Fewer people are dying of preventable disease. More people have access to health care. More farmers are getting their products to market at fair prices. From microfinance projects in Kampala to stock traders in Lagos to cell phone entrepreneurs in Nairobi, there's an energy here that can't be denied. Africa rising.
Obama and his family were in South Africa for several days while the country and the world has been focused on 94-year-old Nelson Mandela, who is in critical condition in the hospital. The Obamas visited Robben Island, where Mandela was imprisoned, and the president paid homage to the ailing leader, saying, "One man's courage can change the world." Obama began his trip in Senegal and today has landed in Tanzania, his third and final stop on his first major trip to the continent. Today on Radio Times, we talk about the legacy of Nelson Mandela and what was and wasn't accomplished by Obama's trip to Africa. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Trudy Rubin. She's the Philadelphia Inquirer foreign affairs columnist. She met and interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000. And Trudy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very good to be here, Mom.
And also with us and joining us from Brookings is Mwangi Kimanyi. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, was born in Kenya. And Mwangi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
I do want to begin with Nelson Mandela, and it should be said he is in critical condition, but it looks, I have to say, as if the end is near. So I don't think it's too soon to talk about his legacy. But Mwangi, what do you see as the legacy of Nelson Mandela?
Actually, even trying to really put down in a few sentences the legacy of Nelson Mandela would be quite unjust. So it's not possible to do it. But I would say that he has really, I would say, the hero for Africans today, and someone who's and the reason why I think that his legacy is important and will remain is that I don't see him as really someone who just die and that's it, because what we refer as the Madiba is an embodiment of some level of humanity that you don't really come to see. So I think the Madiba will live on. And so it's really difficult to really talk about the death of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah. And you're calling him by his affectionate name. Let me put the same question to you, Trudy Rubin. In fact, one of the things that you wrote about in a piece that you wrote recently about Nelson Mandela was his, quote, ability to forgive.
Yes, I mean, I think when I look at what he has achieved and the incredible impact I think he has had both in his own country and globally, there's two aspects that strike me. On a global scale, it's this ability to forgive, summarized in the word reconciliation. In so many places where I have spent time in Iraq, with Syrians, with Palestinians, I keep hearing the phrase, "If only we had a Mandela," because Mandela did something highly unusual. In a bitter sectarian conflict, he chose reconciliation rather than vengeance. That's highly unusual. And the Truth and Reconciliation Committees that worked in South Africa have become the idealistic models. Sadly, those models often don't work elsewhere, I think, in part it was because of his moral influence. And the other thing that has struck me is Mandela was the antithesis of the classic big man leader in Africa. I think he stands as a model and often as an exception in his modest way of life, in the fact that he didn't try to rip off his country, feather his own nest, leave a fortune to his children. If more African leaders would copy that model, the continent would be very different.
And Mwangi, do you think Nelson Mandela is unique among African leaders then?
Oh, exactly. I don't think we have anyone else who comes even close. It's very difficult to put anyone in comparison. And I agree with Twitter in terms of the comments she has made about forgiveness, even after 27 years in prison. And also, you know, being a leader who decides that I will be there for one term, I'm not going to continue. While we see people like Nelson, people like Mugabe, who have been there for ages and they don't want to go. And again, he was transparent. He didn't want to accumulate wealth at the expense of his people. That's unique, and I would say that we don't have anyone else in Africa like that.
Would you say that's his major accomplishment? And I wonder, even when you look at the economy, the life for South Africans today, what would you say, Mwangi, he has done for his people?
I would say, well, the people of South Africa still have a lot of problems, particularly the black community. There is still quite a bit of poverty. So in that's an issue that remains. But he, you know, that was what other leaders are supposed to deal with. But I think bringing people together is the legacy, that South Africa did not go into chaos, or you didn't get people trying to revenge. You know, his reconciliation tone, I think that's the most important thing, that all people can live together and that we can forgive and move on.
Trudy, do you worry about South Africa after Nelson Mandela dies?
Yes. When I interviewed him in 2000, and of course it's something that I remember vividly, he was 81 years old then. He was already retired, recently retired. And he talked with regret about how difficult it was to remedy what he said, you know, 300 years of oppression between colonialism, apartheid. And he said, you know, you can't do it in 5 or 6 years. This was 2000. He had been president from 94 to 99. Right. And I said, you know, will people be patient? And he said, they have patience because they understand this and because they trust in their leadership. And I think that's a critical question. I think that Mandela's, will they continue to trust? Mandela's moral aura and the fact that he didn't steal and that he clearly lived simply enabled people to have patience in a situation where there's still a huge gap between whites and blacks. And now there's a black elite that lives very ostentatiously, but there's still tremendous problems, even though there's been progress. Tremendous problems with education, with institution building, and when with Mandela gone, you wonder, will people have that patience? They believed in him. Will they believe in the African National Congress now that he's gone?
Do you want to add to that, Mwangi? Yeah, go ahead.
I have the same concerns. I have the same worries because it's true when he is there, the leaders have, you know, obviously been careful not to go beyond, you know, not to do some things that would really offend the Mandela. So, you know, we have really a bit concerned that they may start acting in you know, more dictatorial and not follow the Mandela's path. But we do hope that the country has a good civil society that has evolved over time, and even the youth are very active and have actually shown their opposition to the current government. So I think what will happen is that there will be other forces that will try to make sure that the country does not regress. But it will be a big vacuum there when it happens.
Mwangi, do you think President Obama had anything important to say to the people of South Africa?
I think it's good. To me, I think it's important that he went to South Africa and went to Robben Island. I think going to that place surely gives him a connection, you know, sort of sobering connection about what people have gone through, and probably he will take that back to when he comes back, when he thinks about Africa, just like when he went to Gori Ayrad in Senegal. But he had good messages about that. I was very happy. I was actually excited that President Obama is talking about Africa as the rising continent, and he is actually now trying to think about it seriously. His last 4 years have not been that consistent to a rising Africa, but now he's talking about a rising Africa. He's talking about the economic growth, what's happening there, and the importance of the youth and so on. So I was happy that he has started actually talking that message.
Trudy, were you happy as well? I'm looking at your face. Go ahead.
You know, in some ways, the trip seemed more like a personal pilgrimage.
For the president
for
and
the
his
president
family?
And his family, than something that would have a major impact. You know, I mean, it's not a bad thing that he went to Africa. And he was talking mainly about trade and investment and about Africa as a partner. Now, these are all good things, and trade is very critical to any developing countries having better access to U.S. markets. And so if he can achieve that, that's important. But in a sense, what he was demonstrating was America's lessened ability or lessened will to really play an active role. I mean, I think the most active role we're playing in Africa has to do with strategic issues, fighting against terrorism. And even,
drones and things like that.
Yeah, and even then, you know, we're taking a back seat. It's more in partnership with other countries. But I don't think there was much beef there. I mean, the Chinese come in with these huge yeah. government resources and build infrastructure. He wasn't coming with that. He was saying, you're doing well. We're happy to help you with trade and investment. Whether yeah. investment will come, given all the problems that still exist in Africa, is mm-hmm. hard to say. And probably it will be in resources, in minerals, where the results don't trickle down to jobs for people and really lifting them out of poverty. So when you add up the results of the trip, I don't think there's many tangible takeaways.
Well, and just even picking up on that, Mwangi, you've written about the fact that the Chinese are building dams in countries in Africa. Go ahead.
Well, I was trying to be actually polite.
Go ahead. Be polite or impolite. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to be, you know, a little bit polite and give the president credit. But, you know, I agree. I wrote and said that in the end, this trip will be more symbolic than substantive. So I wanted to cite at least there are some substance that have come up, but, you know, we still have to evaluate. But it's true that it's a bit sad because if you listen to his messages and what he's trying to do, that's what other countries have been doing before. They've been entrenching their investments in Africa. So the president is there telling Africans, we also want to catch up with China and Brazil and everybody else. That's really not a very good message for coming from the president of the United States. But anyway, at least he's trying to catch up. That's good.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I want to pick up on things that both of you have said and also open up the lines. We are talking about President Obama's trip to Africa, beginning with Senegal, was in South Africa, and today he's in Tanzania. Talking with Trudy Rubin, she's the Philadelphia Inquirer foreign affairs columnist, actually met and interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000. Mwangi Kimani is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was born in Kenya, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington supports WHYY and presents French Twist, masterworks of photography from Atjeh to Man Ray, on view through September 15th. Featuring vintage black and white prints from the golden age of French photography, this exhibition includes pioneering photojournalism, lyrical views of Paris streets and gardens, notorious creatures of the night, and surrealist experiments. For more information, 302-571-9590 or delart.org.
Don't think tubas, trumpets, and accordions have a place in pop? Then you haven't been listening to Mexican pop.
You know, Julieta Venegas makes it look positively sexy when she picks up the accordion on stage. I think I developed my crush on her when I saw her play the accordion.
Music journalist Josh Norick is our guide as the Sound Opinions World Tour heads south of the border.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, new co-host for Here and Now. Join Robin Young and me on WHYY at 1 p.m., a full 2 hours of all the news that breaks after Morning Edition and before All Things Considered. And, of course, the local news you've come to rely on each and every day. Here and now on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about President Obama's first major trip to the continent of Africa. Again, beginning in Senegal over the weekend, he was in South Africa, and today he is in Tanzania. Talking with Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer and Mwangi Kimenyi from the Brookings Institution, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Trudy, on Friday I posted on our Facebook page, you know, who's done the most for Africa, President Clinton, President Bush, or President Obama? Do you have an answer to that question? Go ahead.
Well, it isn't President Obama. That's what we can say, for sure. I think it's ironic that President Obama is in Africa at the same time as former President George W. Bush, who actually did a lot for Africa with the PEPFAR program to fight AIDS. When I was in South Africa in 2000, HIV was rampant, and there was no money for antiretrovirals drugs, and it was a tragic situation. In addition, at that point, President Mbeki in South Africa was denying that the virus caused AIDS, and so that was an additional problem. But the fact is that President George W. Bush put a lot of money into this program, which really helped provide funding for the drugs and has, in many areas of Africa, helped to get the spread under control, even though it is still widespread. And ironically, under President Obama, funding for PEPFAR has been cut. Now, granted, Bush was president at a time when money was less of an object. Now we're in the age of budget cutbacks. It's a different time. But it is an irony that a man of African descent who cares about the continent has presided over the cutting of a signature program.
What do you think, Mwangi? Go ahead.
Well, actually, there is no comparison. Obama does not feature anywhere when it comes to either looking at President Clinton or President Bush. And I would say that I was looking at the African press over the last few days. And it's sad when they look at start talking pretty negative about President Obama. He abandoned Africa, and they praise President Clinton. They praise George W. Bush, and the frustration is that this is the president you would have expected to actually be out there talking about Africa more and being proud of Africa. But it appears to me like he has not been actually very proud of Africa. I could almost say that he has been ashamed to bring Africa to the forefront. And that's my disappointment with the president. So I would say, to answer your question about President Clinton and President Bush, I'll give this to they were at different times, that also defines their legacies. They did very well. But I would also pick President Bush as having done extremely well. And the reason is Africans didn't expect much from Republicans, for example. And yet this is someone who came and surprised us. I mean, so that's why he has a position in Africa. He has a very good legacy. But of course, again, as I say, President Clinton is sort of a rock star in Africa. And I don't think President Obama is going to approach his fame or respect.
Well, that's interesting. And I don't want to get too far afield here, but Trudy Rubin, as someone who covers U.S. foreign policy, it seems that Obama has disappointed just about every country around the world. I mean, would that be a fair analysis?
You know, sometimes looking back at the last 4-plus years, going on 5, it is hard to understand. I mean, one wonders whether it's simply a staffing problem, an attention problem, a learning curve problem. But it is hard to understand. Africa is it's not an easy continent to address as a whole. Despite the term Africa rising, the fact is that it's a commodity boom that's leading to the rise in growth, and poverty levels are stubbornly high, not coming down, infrastructure problems, terrible education problems, and in countries like Nigeria that are rich in oil, poverty is actually increasing. Mm-hmm. So, but if you pick an area, as President Bush did, you can make a huge difference in the lives of people. And I don't know. Was it a lack of attention? I just don't know.
Let me ask you something, Mwangi, about whether we're seeing, not just from the United States, but other countries as well, making that shift from aid, you know, to deal with droughts and starvation and civil wars, to trade. And perhaps this is when we can get the discussion about China in on the mix here. But do you see that as a shift?
Well, I think it's the time for that shift. I would say that aid remains important. You know, as we talked about those programs that dealt with aid, for example, there have been some chronic issues that aid has helped. But for long-term development, aid is not the answer. It is really more trade investment, you know, sort of business cooperation. And I think that is the model now that we are looking forward for. That's what we, at least from my perspective, thinking about long-term growth of Africa, what we would like to see and what we think will work is where you have private sector being more involved. But as we know, as today has mentioned, Africa is actually a difficult place, and you have different countries that are difficult to do business. And that's where governments come in. And the reason why China is doing well in those areas is because the government is actually supporting its private sector get inroads into Africa. And that's why I think U.S. need to play a bigger role.
But are there too many dictators and strongmen and corrupt leaders? Trudy was talking about Nigeria. And the fact that it's just, you know, wealth, their oil wealth is phenomenal. And yet you have so many poor people living in that country.
If I could step in and say, our governments are not perfect, but if you look at over the last 10 years, you find a lot of improvement, even in terms of the environment for doing business. Africa leads in terms of improvements. We have dictators. We have some regimes that are not totally democratic, but if you look at it again about improvement, they've been improving. We need to do more. We still need to do more.
You agree with that, Trudy?
The thing that is so frustrating to me about Africa, I mean, I've been in Nigeria, a dynamic population, a lot of educated, talented people, many of whom emigrate because they simply cannot deal with the corruption, which keeps talented people, businessmen and so forth, from being able to operate in a way that would lift up the country. You know, I've read statistics that poverty in Nigeria has actually increased since 2004. 61% of the population live on less than a dollar a day. I mean, unemployment among youth, and the youth bulge is enormous, is 40%. So you want to push trade because this is the way up. But in order for trade to lift up the population, you have to be able to have small and medium-sized businesses, not just investment in natural resources, which may not create jobs and can increase the inequality in the country.
Mwangi, one of the things that the president said and others have said as well is that in sub-Saharan Africa, something like a majority of the population doesn't have electricity.
That's true. In terms of reliance on commodities, that has been the story. But the growth is changing. We have actually better growth now. The last 10 years are not just commodity-driven. You have technology. You have more diversification of the economies. So the new growth in Africa is actually different from just commodity-driven growth. But again, I agree that natural resources are not the way, are not always way. They create inequality, don't create jobs. And so on. Now, infrastructure is the big problem for Africa. And in fact, we write about this all the time. It's not just electricity. You are talking about communication infrastructure, whether it's roads. I mean, everything. That's where actually We need Africa needs cooperation with other private sector outside the country. That's where we think that there are also profitable investment opportunities to open up Africa. I agree that initiatives like in electricity are very important because they will also have salutary benefits for other businesses.
But we're talking about basic things like roads and bridges and dams, yes, and that kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah. The Africa, we talk about Africa having a major infrastructural deficit, and that's really the key to Africa sustainable growth, is really at least reducing this deficit. And the idea of electricity is a good one.
And that's Mwangi Kimenye. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Joins us along with Trudy Rubin, Philadelphia Inquirer foreign affairs columnist. We are talking about President Obama's trip to three countries in Africa and talking generally about some of the potential in Africa, some of the problems as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Let me get Peter from, looks like Sicklerville, New Jersey, to join us. Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning, Mother.
Good morning.
I've got a couple of issues here. Trudy mentioned about a dollar a day in Africa.
Nigeria.
But I would like just to make a comment that in the United States, I think a lot of people live under a dollar a day if you look at the income that, you know, and expenses. That's number one. Number two, for Mr. Mwangi, what do you think about Obama not visiting Kenya, the country of his father's birth? And then number two, number three also, China's influence in Kenya particularly compared to the West. I believe the West had ignored the continent, and China has been progressively making inroads into the country, and the West is behind. Is now playing like a catch up game.
Well, Peter, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me take the second point about the fact that President Obama is in Tanzania today, but not in Kenya. Mwangi, is that a mistake? Go ahead.
Of course, it's a big mistake, but we will forgive him for it. So,
why?
he is our son. Nevertheless, I think let me. I understand. I do understand why he didn't visit Kenya. We have a problem in terms. Okay, we just got a new. We have a new election. We have new leadership, and apparently been indicted by the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And he felt that going to Kenya before that matter is resolved would be a mistake. So, in that sense, I do understand. But Kenya is where his family is. I would have liked him to, you know, people can make private visit. I would have liked him to go and visit his relatives. His grandmother is there. He should go and lay a wreath on his father's grave, because even when a country has problems, you don't ignore your family. I think, to me, I would have liked him to go there. So in that sense, I think maybe he did promise. He had that question throughout his trip, and he did say that he will be going to Kenya before the next 3 years.
Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me pick up on the China comment, Trudy, and I'd like to hear from both of you. Is it easier for China to invest in countries in Africa because it is essentially a dictatorship and they don't have the same kind of Congress that President Obama has to deal with? Does that make it easier for them?
Of course. I mean, China has, excuse me, huge reserves of hard currency, mammoth. And the government just spends. They go in there and they build infrastructure. Now, China builds infrastructure strategically. I haven't seen it in Africa, but I've seen it in Afghanistan, where I've traveled a lot. You know, China is building roads in Afghanistan. They will build it to where they want to extract natural resources. They will bring in entirely Chinese labor crews, down to the cooks. they will give virtually no jobs to the local people. It does cause a lot of resentment. Just recently in Ghana, you had attacks on Chinese wildcat miners who actually were there illegally. But so on the one hand, China has this enormous capital resources and they can make it happen. Then they bring in their state-owned companies to extract the resources. They don't create jobs, and they, if they do hire locals, it's often bad working conditions. And so they're not a nice investor, but they come in and they build big things, which makes people sit up and take notice.
Mm. I mean, should we emulate the China model?
We don't.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first
not
of all,
first of all,
I don't think China is totally bad. There are some things that you would consider suboptimal, but you know, people been talking about China, you know, looking for resources, polluting the environment. You gotta go to the Niger Delta, the delta in Nigeria, where Chevron has been operating. It's the most polluted place in the world. These companies are American. So we should not be so much anti-China without looking at what American companies themselves have done in exploiting natural resources. They are the same in many respects. And in fact, when it comes to job creation, these companies that operate, oil companies also in the Delta region of Nigeria, they just pump the oil. They have American workers. They just pump the oil to the to the things. So, but in terms of infrastructure that China is building, there is a change in many cases. In Kenya, for example, we don't have those natural resources, but China is collaborating in building a road. But this is not actually the aid per se. Kenya has borrowed money from the African Development Bank, but Chinese companies are doing the construction as a venture, and they employ Kenyans too. So there are things to reform about China's operation, but they are not that totally bad also.
But go ahead, Trina.
And I was just going to say, the Chinese will go in and build infrastructure where Western companies won't come in. And where Western private, first of all, the Chinese will build infrastructure with government funds, so they're not looking to make money from it. And for whatever reason they're doing it, it's still the infrastructure. And in addition, they will take risks and build in bad conditions that Western governments, even if they give the money, you know, won't find subcontractors who will do it.
Well, Mwangi, but I'm at a minute before our second break here, but what do you think then the United States, since the president talked about some kind of trade relationship, what do you think the U.S. can do and do well in countries in Africa?
I think the best way is really working with the African private sector, sort of joint partnerships, investment in areas, encouraging American businesses to invest in areas where they can transform economies. We need agricultural transformation, agricultural processing. Because still, when we talk about really long-term growth, we can't be talking about commodities. We need to build fertilizer companies, for example, fertilizer factories. So what we are really looking for when we talk about American engagement is really commercial relationship that improve the productivity of Africans in terms of transforming the economies. That's really the key, and there are many approaches to deal with that.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. That's Mwangi Kimenyi. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, joining us from their studios. He was born in Kenya. Also with us and here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Trudy Rubin. She's the Philadelphia Inquirer's foreign affairs columnist. She has reported from all over the world. In fact, met and interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000. And again, we're taking calls, talking about President Obama's trip to three countries in Africa and U.S. relationship with that continent. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey supports WHYY and announces Wheaton Wide Open, featuring daily glassmaking demonstrations and family art activities. No admission tickets required during July. Presented by PNC Arts Alive. Details at wheatonarts.org.
On the next Fresh Air, children's author Tommy Ungerer. Like his friend Maurice Sendak, Ungerer's work helped change children's books in the 1950s and 60s. But after he began drawing adult erotica, his books were banned from American libraries. Ungerer is the subject of a new documentary called...
Far Out is Not Far Enough.
And that's
one of my sayings.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More at Lincoln.com.
The hunt for the American who leaked details about national security surveillance programs plays out as a story about secrets and lies. Secrets and lies can erode trust in any relationship, at home, at work, and certainly with the powers that be. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, what's behind the secrets and lies we tell? When are they helpful? And when are they hurtful? Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, we are talking about President Obama's trip to three countries in Africa and talking about the potential in that continent, some of the problems as well. And again, our guests are Trudy Rubin and Mwangi Kimenyi, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mwangi, let me go back to you, and I wonder whether... And we're speaking, obviously, about a continent here, Africa's reputation and its image, frankly, over the years of a place for civil wars, a place for droughts, mass starvations, human rights abuses, that there's a sense, and maybe this is what the president was talking about when he talked about rising Africa or Africa rising, that this is not a basket case continent anymore.
Yeah, so it's true that... There have been a lot of problems in Africa, and what they signal to people, let's say, in the United States, is that even if this happens in one country, let's say it's happening in Somalia, people generalize and say, you know, Africa is in chaos, and it's not a good place to invest. But Africa is actually a very large continent. The countries are very large. And so there are problems, but that does not necessarily mean it's a bad place to invest. But also the continent has changed over the last 10, 15 years. So the message that the president is actually passing, which is what I see as probably the contribution. Forget about a lot about talking about some programs, but I think the idea of signaling that Africa has changed, particularly to the American people, I think is important. I think it's a good signal for investors, but he should have done this long time ago.
And where are the bright spots in Africa?
Okay, so we do have, I would say, actually, if you look at the southern, let's say, where are the trouble spots? So you have the Democratic Republic of Congo. Right. It has been a perennial real problem. And the reason why that happens is because you have so many people competing for the natural resources there. It's an extremely wealthy place. We had, of course, the Somalia and South Sudan and Sudan issues. They have not been totally resolved. Those are problem areas that are actually quite significant, although they are changing. Then in West Africa, of course, we had Sierra Leone, we had Liberia, we had Ivory Coast. All those have been trouble spots. But again, the trajectory is more positive. We are moving away from an area where you had a lot of civil conflict to an area where you have more peace in the continent. So I don't want to run away with that Africa has problems, but the trajectory is really improving.
Trudy, do you want to add to that?
What's interesting to me, during the break, Marie and I were talking about Nigeria. When I was in both South Africa and Nigeria in 2000, the mantra was that those two countries were the powerhouses that were going to move the whole of Africa forward. Mm-hmm. And Nigeria, to me, is a bellwether because it could do so much. It has such a talented population. It has the oil resource. And yet you now have a phenomenon where Islamists in the north are taking advantage of enormous unemployment, total lack of education. The figures, I think, in the north of Nigeria, 60% of the population in the north has no formal education. And so, you know, I keep trying to figure out how can you get from here to there? And I think more than outside intervention, it takes leadership at the country level, especially in a place like Nigeria. And what I worry is there's a lot of countries in a belt along the Sahel, where you now have a new problem, which is political instability from Islamic jihadis. Mm. And, that's only a certain area. I don't know how that affects the whole, and it doesn't affect the, bright spots that Mwangi would mention, but that worries me.
Go ahead, Mwangi.
Yes, I think that's a very good analysis. We have some countries, I call them anchor countries, because what happens in those countries lifts other countries. And I would say, for example, in West Africa, it's Nigeria. And in fact, in some of my writings, I've been saying that presidents should actually figure out how to engage with Nigeria. Because if Nigeria moves, it's going to lift a lot of other countries. But it's true, you have this, first of all, it's a very rich country. You have very dynamic people. Then you have this, the North. At one time, we said there need to be a Marshall Plan, sort of a Marshall Plan to deal with the North. So Nigeria is a problem, and it could really lift many other countries. Although I have seen, for example, the new finance minister is actually trying a lot in terms of policy reforms, anti-corruption issues, and so on. But let me be honest and say Nigeria is a tough neighborhood.
Tough neighborhood. Let me get, it looks like Ishmael from Newark, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Ishmael, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes, it's very important to understand the difference in the investors coming from between China and the Western countries, including the United States. When the West goes into Africa to make computers, they're not just making computers. They want to influence your social, your culture, you everything, and they tell you how to live your culture, while the Chinese don't. And remember, Africa have memory of colonial West. And the Commonwealth was an attempt to keep influence of those colonies while British on top of the Commonwealth. Don't worry about the fact that once in a while a Ghanaian will be the head of the Commonwealth. It has no meaning. So the West is still trying to colonize, not just do business, but try to influence everything, social, religious, and everything. And the people who fight those kind of things, they are called radicals and all these new names. But we remember colonialism. And Africa still don't control their economy when you're talking about those kind of modern economic structure.
Well,
Ishmael, so there's a big difference.
I hear you. No, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And actually, Mwangi, let me toss that first to you as someone who was born in Kenya. Go ahead.
Yeah, I hate to generalize and say Western investments comes with all these issues because it is it does happen and used to happen, just like aid used to be tied to particular areas. But I think we are now seeing, we are at a point where the competition between Western and, let's say, the emerging economies or the Eastern countries for investments and doing business in Africa is going to bring about the best business. I mean, we have a choice now. We are going to make choices. And so I don't think we are going to have anyone dictating how a particular country behaves and so on. So to me, competition is good. And that's what will allow us to choose the best. And of course, we need to be in charge of how we what investments we take and how we negotiate. And there are issues there, yeah.
Well, and he talks about the legacy of colonialism. Do you think there's some truth to that, Trudy?
You know, it's there is a two-edged sword here. China would do business with a mass murderer that was slaughtering their own people, and they wouldn't give a hoot. So that's fine. And perhaps the legacy of colonialism is such that Africans like the caller or African Americans like the caller think, well, that's a fine thing. Don't interfere in our business. If our leaders want to massacre our own people or do all kinds of horrible things, fine. And that's China's approach. China doesn't care if there's a genocide. China just wants to do business. Now, frankly, most American companies, private companies like oil companies, resource extraction, you know, some of them wouldn't care either, maybe. But you know, there certainly has been a call from the international human rights community, including human rights groups within Africa, including groups like Transparency International within Africa, who want the West to stand for best practices in governance, who want the West to insist on, if they do business with, contracts with African companies, on transparent books and a lessening of corruption, who want President Obama to stand up for human rights. So you have to balance it. You know, I don't know that it was a great thing for Obama to be talking about gay marriage in a Muslim country like Senegal. That's a particular human rights issue that has resonance in the United States, but not in Senegal. On the other hand, I don't think it's a bad thing to stand up for workers' rights, to stand up for women's rights, to stand up for basic human rights and anti-corruption issues. As an American leader, I would rather see the U.S. president make a point of those things than not.
Do you want to add to that, Mwangi? Then we'll get back to our other caller. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I think you are right. But again, the private businesses coming to Africa seem to have actually been involved in all these violations. So I think what we need to do again is for Africans to take charge how they engage. And I mentioned about the pollution in the Delta. American companies are the ones doing business in Angola, where you have a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you look at the history of extraction of natural resources, it's really the same. And the corruption in those countries have been really a partnership, including with the Western companies. So it's really not just by the Nigerian government. There has been a partnership with the oil companies and others doing business there. So I think we need to move to these transparency issues for all the companies, for all those people doing business in Africa.
When you talk about, you know, that Africans have to take control of this and more transparency and obviously more income sharing, if the leadership is not going to do it, is there a middle class? Are there mid-level people who can make this happen?
I think this is changing now. We have been doing a program on oil transparency in countries, new oil economies like in Uganda that's supposed to start dealing with this. We have a Brookings as a program that we are working on oil transparency and management, also in Kenya and South Sudan. And what we have seen is that now the civil society is coming up. We want to know what type of contracts you have. We want to know the revenues. Let's see how they are shared. So the issue of transparency now is getting traction. And the more the active the civil society is, I think we will be improving. And I expect to see this changing.
Hey, Ishmael, thanks for the call. Let's see what John from the Poconos has to say. John, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm actually just returned from Congo, DRC, Goma, where I was managing a hospital. And prior to that, lived in Gabon, Ivory Coast, and was married to the daughter of Ken Sarawiwa, who people may know.
Oh, really? My goodness, John.
Yeah, so I have a lot to say.
I bet.
Probably won't be able to capture it all in a short moment, but I think you've touched on it to a certain extent. But the reality is that the way the Chinese, the way we have to work, if I was representing an American company, would be that we have a certain moral construct that we have to fulfill, and we're constantly being analyzed. As a Citibanker, I couldn't give gifts, for example, or receive gifts. The Chinese work under completely different sort of perspective or motivation. In addition to that, what you have throughout the continent is not just the corruption issue, which really stifles business and investment, because since the beginning of time that we've been giving money and funds to Africa, through all these billions of dollars that have gone to Africa. In fact, the continent in total is poorer than it has been in 50 years. So all this money is going in. It's just not, in essence, being effectively applied, partly because of corruption and endemic sort of tribalist or internal conflict. It's a very difficult place to do business and do it effectively, do it honestly.
John, I do appreciate the call. Can we put you on hold and just get some information about you? Because we might want to do a follow-up one day.
Sure.
Okay. We're gonna do that. But let me, Trudy, give you a chance to respond to what he said.
You know, this certainly is what strikes me about the situation because, first of all, he's right. There are rules that constrain U.S. Companies about bribes. You know, on the other hand, as Mwangi said, you know, the oil companies pay the money to the country, and they don't care where it goes. Now the oil companies are not in a position to tell, you know, the leader of Nigeria whether he can steal or not. They're not going to prevent it, so you could say they're in cahoots, but they're not going to help it. And they have presided over a lot of environmental degradation. But I still do think it comes back to the leadership of the country, because if the leaders don't care about environmental degradation, if all they care about is siphoning off funds. I remember driving on roads north in Nigeria, two-lane roads, the main highways, full of potholes, something like a back roads road in Alabama. There is no justification for that. I remember going to schools in Nigeria where there were no windows, there was no paper, there were no books. This is a country that is floating on oil. So, I mean, in this environment, if the governments are not educating the population for the jobs that could come, if they're not building the infrastructure that enables investors to come in and have a reliable source of transport and electricity, and Nigeria has the money, then I don't exactly know what can be done.
I'm wanting about a minute before I have to say goodbye. Just final thoughts from you. Go ahead. I'm sorry to do
that.
I would say that,
yes, we have problems, and I think Africans are moving, and I agree that countries like Nigeria need to do a lot more, but the leadership issue is really the key. I agree with that. It's a leadership question that we have to focus on.
And since President Obama will be returning to the States later this week, Mwangi, what do you hope the first thing he does is...
when he comes?
Yeah, well, when he goes back to the U.S., what are you looking for him to do?
Well, I mean, in terms of Africa or
yes.
generally?
Yeah, no, in terms of Africa.
Well, I think he will make a very good statement about how he has been able to engage Africa and how U.S. is really regaining its position. So I think in terms of policy, he will try to push some trade bills and investment bills. I think that's the only thing he can do at this point.
Well, Mwangi Kimenyi, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio
Times.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I appreciate having you on the show as well. Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Trudy Rubin, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And she's the Philadelphia Inquirer Foreign Affairs columnist, and we appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.